I'm Justin Katz. It's December 1st, 2017, and Last Impressions 41 is a contemplation of mortality and gratitude. Okay, well, fair warning, I've had a couple of weeks of, let's say, a disrupted schedule. And to give you some sense of how disrupted, this somewhat laid-back, easy-to-produce episode was going to be my taking-a-week kind of off Thanksgiving Friday episode of Last Impressions. It's now December 1st, the week later, and I'm going to utilize that card now. So this episode has no politics, at least not directly. It deals mainly with, I guess you'd say, philosophy. So if that's not your thing, well, you know, you don't feel obligated to listen. Turn it off whenever you want. Still, you know, send me checks and advertising and all that kind of stuff. But don't feel like you have to listen all the way through. I'm not going to go into great detail of actual circumstances, but I've had cause recently to think about illness, children, what we expect out of our lifespans, and, you know, what better way could there be to work through one's thoughts on a matter of huge personal and private significance than through a quasi-extemporaneous ramble in a permanent medium available to the public, like a podcast. I mean, it's just, this is what these were made for, I guess, right? So, now, I could be wrong on this, but I get the sense that most people don't spend much time thinking about the length of time in a normal life, or even really what they want to do with it. And so when somebody gets news that he or she may not be in that normal category for lifespan, suddenly it can feel, you know, it feels like time crunches in on itself, I think. Periodically, you know, one comes across a report in the news, or you can picture a 60 Minutes type show, and the show where the news story will be about a study that found, again, how the desirability of a thing changes depending on whether somebody else expresses an interest in it. You can picture, say, one of those hidden camera experiments where they put kids in a room and they're none of them are playing with the sort of the ugly doll in a corner until some other kid comes in and starts playing with it. And then suddenly, ooh, that's the toy I want. You can also think of it in I don't know if you're allowed to even use examples like this, but you can think of it in romantic relationships, how somebody becomes more attractive when you find out that they have suitors, that there's somebody interested in them. And I think something similar in principle happens with abstract notions that people don't think much about, like a lifespan. So, I mean, obviously, most people want to live as long as they can. On the other hand, when you read that the average lifespan of Americans has gone up, or I don't know if it's gone down ever in recent memory, but up or down a little bit, you know, it's an interesting data point. Maybe it's good or bad, but it, you know, people go on with their lives and say that's how it goes. You know, we're going to live longer. We're not going to live as long. Okay. Who cares in your 70s, right? Until you're in your 60s and 70s. But if you find out, in contrast, if you find out that some illness or maybe a behavior puts you in a category that's got a little bit of a lower on average lifespan, then that it can put it's the kind of thing that can put a knot in your throat, you know? And I'm suggesting here that knot is overly distracting. We tend, or at least I tend, to see things like actuarial categories, you know, this is the expected lifespan, make this adjustment and it's this and that and the other thing, you know, which I deal with all the time with pensions and figuring out how long people are going to to actually collect on their pensions that assumed they were going to not collect on it that long. But we tend to see these actuarial categories as just really different categories, almost like the target and the expected lifespan. I once read an article in which a guy, he read somewhere in his midlife crisis period about that the average lifespan was, let's call it 70. And so he calculated how many days that had him left and put them all in a big vase, of that number in a big vase. And every day he took one marble out. And then the impetus for the article, the essay, was that he had reached the end. And at that point, everything became a gift. It was a day he wasn't supposed to have. And that's, I think that's the wrong way to look at it. That's only valid if we make us all a category. You're in your category. This is how long you will live. But of course, an average lifespan means that half of people live longer than advertised. And much of how that breaks down, a lot of it's just chance, a lot of it's genetic, but a lot of it is also how they live their lives. So to get to the average, you know, you have to include, you know, everybody who gets an unexpected disease, everybody who dies in an accident or some kind of violence, everybody who smokes or sits around all day doing nothing, not moving around. And you take all those people out, and the average ought to move up, but you don't often get that running calculation of what can affect your life. So in that light, having some, say, an illness that isn't immediately fatal presents the same basic questions that face us when we're just normal. First of all, that's true because having a disease, and to be clear, I don't have a disease of this nature, but having that sort of thing over you, if you live healthy and you're at the positive end of the bell curve, you're probably well overlapping a lot of the people who are, quote, normal, who, even if you don't live to the bell curve, if you're out of the normal curve. So that's one reason. But the other reason is, you know, you could still have decades and decades of life. I remember not long ago, for some purpose, I think a friend of mine was doing the Leadership RI program and was profiling me for it. And they did this thing, and it told you about yourself. And somebody else later asked me, oh, what'd you think of that thing? Because they had been looking at the test. I said, you know, it was like when you were in high school and you took that test that told everybody they were supposed to be bus drivers, that was their ideal career or what have you. I said, it was a lot of obvious stuff. It didn't really tell me anything I didn't know. And the person said, well, you know, I don't think most people probably think about these things as much as you do. So I may be off, but how many people really have sat down and come up with an overarching life goal and then concluded that they need a certain number of decades to achieve that life goal? And under those circumstances, you might, finding out that you don't have that many decades could be a discouraging prospect because you have that life goal you're shooting toward. But I don't think many people think in those terms. So, you know, all of us, or not all of us, but in general, we have a certain number of decades on Earth. And the question is, you know, for all of us, what are you going to do with them? In some regards, then, those with diseases or behaviors that are akin to disease, long-term diseases, are mainly different in the amount of information that they have. I mean, when I was very young, one of my aunts died at 31 with minimal warning. Then, you know, flash forward about 30 years, and my mother was in her early 60s when she passed away. And not that long ago, my father's mother, my grandmother, was in her mid-90s. None of them knew, say, early in their lives, in the planning, ramping up for life portion of their lives, or even toward the end, within, say, a five-year period. None of them knew, or sorry, outside of a five-year period of when they passed away, none of them knew early on which of them was going to get which of those three options. So basically, upon discovery of some illness, you've just got more knowledge. And if you are inclined to see things positively and optimistically and hopefully, which I think is good not only for your state of mind, but is probably good for your health too, you can take that knowledge, as discouraging as it may be, and make it into an incentive to live in a healthy, meaningful way. Meaningful so that it means something however long it is. And healthy, so it's, first of all, so it's better while you're engaged in it, and also so that you get to that downward slope on the positive end of the bell curve. That should be the attitude of people who find out that they might not hit the average. And those of us who have no reason, who lack that knowledge, actually, who have no reason to know where we are in a more defined category than normal, we should take that as a lesson for ourselves. So here's where I might get a little too, I want to say metaphysical, but it's actually really kind of physical. Periodically, especially when I'm reading or watching or otherwise absorbing some sort of documentary or study or argument about physics, I ponder how actual things in the world differ up a kind of a chain. Now, what I mean by that is that, so start with, say, inanimate objects like a rock. It only responds to direct influence. Something hits it right now and it responds in some way. Even if that something is, say, sunlight or whatever. It's hit and the molecules on it, the atoms, respond from the impact, whatever, however that might manifest. Now, that's always a rock in that sense, is always in the present. Now, that you advance to, say, simple life like plants. Now, they differ mainly, I think, in their ability to respond to direct stimulation. Well, that's not what I think. That's actually what life does. But so a plant responds to direct stimulation. Water, sun, it does something. It moves itself. It transfers something. It acts within itself. But not with what could be called a memory, and certainly not with prediction. Now, I guess you could say that's not really even that different from inanimate objects. The main difference is that the outside stimulus triggers some internal series of events. There's no decision process. It just, the water does this. It just happens internally. So it seems as if the object, the item, the plant, is actually doing something when it's mainly just responding. Now, animals, however, begin to respond to things in the past and the future. And that's a big difference. So the deer sees the wolf. And in some sense, the deer is responding to a potential future in which the wolf charges and attacks it. a fun one to think about, you know, if you're like me, is on a highway and a speed trap. So you see a cop in the middle of the highway facing out, and suddenly there's traffic. Everybody's slamming on their brakes, trying to slow down, you know, as if you're not caught, right, at that point. But what they're actually doing, the cop isn't chasing them. The cop may not even be in a car, might not even be awake, right, or might be playing on his or her cell phone, which, you know, you see from time to time, as long as they're parked, right? What's causing that traffic isn't a particular action, or even a near-term immediate threat of being hit or something. It's the future, a potential future in which that cop pulls out and tags you and gives you a ticket for speeding. That future is causing the traffic. So human beings not only can predict, well, respond to a future condition like the deer can with the wolf, but also kind of abstractions. So that would be not only more distant and indirect futures and less feasible futures that can still be taken into account, but also abstractions like ideas. We can respond to ideas. Ideas can change the world, even false ideas. But for me, for my point here, what's important is that the future, and even if it's only a possible future, can act on the present through us, through people, as if it is real. Now, of course, the likelihood of some event makes it more powerful, which is where the actuaries come in, trying to narrow down what actions should be more, what futures should be more powerful, I guess, in our decision making. But I think generally with things like illnesses, we get to, and potential bad things in the future, even a distant future, we get too future oriented. I know when I was in middle school, I think it was eighth grade, but it could have been seventh. Middle school, we actually called it junior high where I grew up in New Jersey, and it went from seventh to ninth grades. I had this strange experience that I still kind of remember in detail. I've mentioned before that I was a Boy Scout, and I didn't really like camping, at least in the summer. I had some issues with the woods all generally and roughing it, but in the, did I say summer? Even especially in the winter, I dreaded some of those. I mean, I wasn't a skier, so there wasn't like there was this fun thing that I was waiting to do, and you know, it was cold, and roughing it is a lot harder in the cold. And so there's one day just before a weekend trip. I want to say it was January, but I don't know that for a fact. I was sitting in my room getting some homework done because I wasn't going to be home until late Sunday. And it must have been Friday or Thursday if it was a 3-day week. I don't recall that detail. But I was sitting in my seat doing my homework, and the sun was setting over the apartment building across the sort of courtyard in our apartment complex. And I was comforting myself about this dreaded camping trip in the winter by thinking that, you know what, in just a few days, I'll be right back here in this seat watching the sun set again. And I applied my imagination, my abstract human imagination, and I could put myself in that future moment right now. And that was a comfort to me until it occurred to me that I could do the same thing with my entire lifespan. And so if I use my imagination, I could put myself at the moment of my death. And that was not a happy realization for me in middle school. I mean, for a long time after that, months, it could have been, I think it might have even racked up to years. I don't know, it didn't really, the feeling didn't really go away. It just sort of, well, it did eventually go away, but it wasn't like something happened to make it go away. But for a long time, I felt kind of like I was looking back on my life rather than living it. It became like a malignant cycle. By that, what I mean is, if the feeling would go away, this kind of dark, backwards, inverted feeling of time went away, I would realize it went away, and that would suddenly bring it back, and that wasn't good. I had no tools, especially growing up without a religion, to get out of that cycle. And it happened again in my early 20s. I remember I had just gotten married. I had one of those very busy, stressful years. I graduated college, got married, found a job, and moved my apartment. We moved our apartment. So it was a whole lot of changes all at once. And my wife was watching some silly Kirstie Alley movie where she, I don't know if she dies or just somehow goes to the afterlife for a bit. And so she was watching that, and, And I watched some of that, and then I took a shower, and the feeling came back and hit me in the shower again, from after years of sort of, well, it was like a relapse. And that's actually when I really began considering a conversion away from atheism. So I guess the question that anybody still listening would be wondering is, you know, what's the point? What do we do with all of this? And I think what I'm getting at is that without religion, I tended too much to fixate on the future and to answer that with a sort of live for the moment cliche. And that not only didn't answer my concerns about the future, but it limited my planning and made it more difficult for me to do things in a sensible way. I mean, for a while I was seriously, I'm still not sure whether I was actually joking or not, but I would joke kind of to friends that I was going to become a rock star and then die at 27. And it would be Jim, Jimmy, Janice, and Justin. And of course, Kurt Cobain knocked out the alliteration there. But that was the fruit of this sort of existential dread combined with no more profound response than live for the moment. I think the more mature response is to be sure that the present is always kind of the biggest factor. And to be sure that we're concentrating on the people in our lives right now while still being somewhat future-oriented in our planning, being aware of and comfortable with making some assumptions about the future, looking at those actuarial tables, and planning accordingly and honestly. Because the focus is on the present, you can do that. I mean, a meaning in the present, not just living for the moment. Because if your focus is meaning rather than, say, enjoyment or pleasure, then you don't have to be spending money right now to produce the pleasure. You can find meaning even in suffering, even in delayed gratification. So if you can take this attitude, you know, if something isn't likely to happen in the future, you know, don't plan for it. And maybe it's tough to admit that something isn't going to happen, say like a retirement, I pretty much don't expect. But if you're not expecting something, and if you have a reasonable chance of not actually achieving it or getting to that point, then, you know, you don't need to necessarily want to spend much effort planning for it. The challenge, I think, is that if we become overly future-oriented, our feelings kind of shift from what is to what will be. Like I used to, in middle school, junior high school, it was almost like I was scared, as if death was imminent. When somebody else gets bad news or is in danger or something, you can even get to feel sad, as if that person is gone, even if the bad news is for something years and years into the future. Emotionally, we put ourselves into that future date, and that's not healthy. The reason, I should say, that I think this isn't just kind of a useless and morbid rambling podcast, is that it brings us to a binary decision. And because the fact is that everybody will be dead in the future. So we can either be sad and stressed out about that, or we can focus our emotions on the present, find our meaning in the present. And having made that decision, this is what made this appropriate more for last week. Having made that decision to be more oriented in our feelings toward the present, is that Thanksgiving, lowercase t, and gratitude, these are very much present-oriented feelings. We feel thankful for what we have right now. Not what we will have, not even what we have had. I mean, yeah, to some extent, we can be grateful for what we had in the past, or in anticipation for things that we haven't been given yet. Like you could think of a big raise or eternal salvation, you know, whatever, anywhere in there. But what we're actually grateful in it for in those circumstances is the condition that the past or the future gift puts us in right now. So if you know you're coming into a whole bunch of money, you aren't necessarily grateful for that money. You don't have it yet. You might be grateful to your parents, whoever's given it to you someday, for alleviating the stress you would otherwise have right now, but for the knowledge of that windfall. I used to have a lot of trouble with the concept of gratitude. Even if you put aside the fact that I didn't believe in God or a life hereafter, everything seemed so fleeting and temporary. So like when I was a teenager, my feeling was kind of like, yeah, you know, cynical teenager. Gee, great. Thanks for this moment that I get to spend contemplating how soon it's going to be over. You know, dark college stoner stuff, I guess. But, you know, as I get older, it's just so clear how much of a mistake that attitude was. And I think my closing thought would be that, you know, no matter how much time we think we have left, we should be deliberate in two things. Firstly, looking for things for which to be grateful, because that roots us in the present, shows us what's here now, even if we're planning for the future. And also, you know, understanding that there is someone to be grateful to. Because without that, there's not really any gratitude. There's not really any meaning. And on that note, I'd offer you a belated happy Thanksgiving and a premature Merry Christmas. And I'd say, you know, don't spend too much time worrying about first impressions, because, you know, you can always make up for them. You can always change things. The future isn't here yet. Instead, worry about your last impressions, because they can follow you for an eternity. God bless.